Hey, what's going on, guys? On this episode of Drugs and Stuff, to start, Dave and I have steroids in the news. We talk about what looks to be a fishy news article promoting legal steroids. It sounds pretty hokey. We're going to get into that. Then the WWE talks all about one of their guys who was using drugs, but they omit all the information about his steroid use. After that, we talk about C-Link, which is a nootropic peptide, and we cover a bunch of listener questions. We're going to do all that right now here on Drugs and Stuff. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff. I'm Scott McNally, and I'm here, as always, with David Stanley of the UK.
You know, each week, I don't think I could hate you anymore. And then there's just a little bit more you managed to squeeze out of me. What?
Did you like the picture, the thumbnail I made for the last week's episode? We talked about the racehorse on SARMs. And I made I got the horse mask, and I put it on your picture. I thought that looked nice.
It's better than a horse's ass, I suppose. So it's an improvement to what I normally get compared to. So I'll take that as a win.
Excellent. We have some follow up stuff from last week regarding cannabis and cannabis withdrawal and stuff. Dave's got some information for us there. It should be interesting. We have a bunch of listener questions, but before we get to that, we've got steroids in the news. I think Dave just fell asleep. Oh, no, he's still with us.
No, I'm here. I'm waiting for you with your big intros.
Okay, here we go. What's that? What's that, Dave? What was that noise you just made?
It's the dog barking.
So listen, I found this today. This is kind of a little bit tricky to describe here. So I took a couple of screen captures I can share with everybody. This website, let's see if I can pull this up here. Oh, I got to take these off the cloud, I guess, before I can pull them up. I'm looking at this website. It's by, the site's called The Tech Times, okay? And you can go to techtimes.com if you want to check it out yourself. They have, now, my first thought was, is this a fake news story that's linked to buy products? Because, like, as you called it, we discussed this before the show. There's those infomercial type sites that'll be like, you know, all the benefits of HCG and everything HCG can do for you. And then there'll be a link at the bottom that's like, if you're interested in buying HCG, click this link. And then it'll be some sort of weird oral dropper product, you know, in a bottle for $30 or $60. Something weird and fraudulent. Now, this website doesn't seem to be the best website I've ever seen. The Tech Times, I mean, they have all sorts of stories. How would you qualify this website or this news site, Dave?
Scott McNally trying to advertise his wares subliminally on his podcast. That's how I call this website.
Well, here's the deal, okay?
I'd call it Gutter Press.
Gutter Press, yes, exactly. So I'm looking at this site here. I'm looking at this article. It says, legal steroids, are they safe to use? I'm like, okay. And then as I start reading it, I was reading this to Victoria. There were things about this that just stood out to us both instantly. Like, they created terminology. This first line even says, commonly referred to as legal steroids, multi-ingredient pre-workout supplements, also known as MIPS, are an issue for many, but they're also largely misunderstood. First of all, Dave, have you ever heard the term MIPS?
No. No. And I've also never heard, this is like saying that USN tub of anabolic protein powder is steroid powder sort of mentality. I mean, a multi-ingredient pre-workout supplement has no relationship to whether it is a illegal or loophole, i.e. pro-hormone SARM type product.
Yeah.
You know, there's no relation. This just sounds like wrapped up infomercials.
Yeah.
It really does. But there's still a lot of this shit goes on where you'll see these articles written by someone claiming to be whatever in their field, and you know, it's this, this, and this. And then lo and behold, at the bottom, there's a link to the product to buy.
Right.
But this just sounds, I mean, I wouldn't say particularly scam, more just because I would.
Well, hold on, because we haven't even told people. I told you about this a little bit more, but so far people only know about the headline. So as we get into it, it says, what exactly are legal steroids? The term legal steroids basically refer to a family of muscle building supplements. And then there's a link that says, read more about them here. I'll get back to that. They are different from illegal steroids, which are synthetic anabolic androgenic steroids that are made from a manufactured type of testosterone of the male sex hormone. That doesn't even like make complete sense, that sentence, to me.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, yeah, you get what they're saying, and, and the gist of it is not incorrect, but no, it doesn't actually make sense. It's very bad wording.
But, it, you know, if you're somebody who's just reading the Tech Times and you were to come across this article and be like, huh, I've heard steroids could be beneficial, and you know, I wonder about these legal steroids. Maybe this would be an option for me. I could start taking this in the morning while I read Tech Times. You might not know that. You might just think you just don't understand it well because this is not something you learn about. You might think that the term MIPS is just like a trade term. You know, that's just a you know, something we all know, but it's not.
I mean, the thing is, the terminology around legal steroids came about around prohormones and peptides and SARMs and those sort of compounds.
Right, right.
And it was because, I mean, particularly with pro-hormones, because they were effectively steroids, but they, you know, they took advantage of a loophole in legislation that allowed them to be sold as a supplement.
Yes, yes.
Obviously, that's historic now, and particularly in the States, they've got a lot stricter on pro-hormones. They're still a bit gray over here.
Are they? Yeah.
Yeah, they're a bit of a weird... It's not a criminal or a legal offense. It's more a trading standards offense. So it's more around the license to sell the product, that the product's not passed for sale in this country, rather than it is that this is a banned illegal substance. It's not that element of law that they deal with.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the whole legal steroid marketplace initially. And as time's gone on, that term has now really encompassed anything that you want to call a legal steroid, because one, it's not illegal, and two, you're claiming it has some form of anabolic action.
Yeah.
So now you've got supplements that are purely almost herbal.
Yeah, yeah.
That are being claimed as being legal steroids, which is just absolute bollocks. But obviously, the word steroid, you know, brings up images of powerful muscle growth agents. And that's why it's used. And that's the whole reason why this terminology is put in these things, is because people associate large amounts of muscle growth with the term steroids.
Yeah. Now, so if you go into this further, it says how to use them. Legal alternatives are also in the form of a powdered drink or a capsule that you can take with your morning shake or just with water. They go in to explain all this. Now, mind you, too, this is in a news result, Google News. If you search anabolic steroids, Google News picks this up as a news article to help educate you about legal steroids. Now, but here's the deal. When you go back up to that top and it says read more about them, you end up with this website. Now, these guys are linking directly to this site to buy products like Decaduro, D-Ball, spelled B-A-L, D-B-A-L. I mean, these are like the worst possible. I mean, first of all, dude, these things do nothing, like absolutely nothing. But here's what I imagine is that somebody reads Tech Times, which is a semi, I guess, barely legit news source. I mean, they have articles about everything, about things that are happening with COVID right now, things that are happening with NASA. And then they have this article squeezed in there. Do you think this company actually paid for that article to be dropped in the middle of that?
As far as I'm concerned, it's an infomercial. Mm-hmm. You know, it is an advertisement that's disguised as an article to dupe those. The problem is with most of us is we don't read. Mm. We scan. We headline.
Yeah.
We cherry pick, but we don't actually read. So, you know, a lot of people will react to headlines. And then when you actually read the article attached to the headlines, the story of the article is actually quite substantially different to the headline. The media is terrible for that because headlines grab people's attention.
Yeah.
And we tend not to sit and read and digest the information, but we will just read either headers or paragraphs or bits. And that's what these are designed for. They're designed to put information across, which is sales information, in a way that makes it appear that it's a factual report and an independent factual report, but hidden in there will be the product name or a product link so that you can go and buy it. And all the terminology on the products is used to link the association with steroids because of the thought process and the growth impact that we associate with steroid use.
Yeah, yeah.
So hence the names. You know, the names aren't because they are like those steroids. The names are because they give us an indication that this might be a powerful drug.
Mm, yeah. It's weird, man. And I feel bad for anybody who does just stumble on this. And actually, I do and I don't, because if they just stumble on this and they just go by this alone, they're kind of they get what they deserve. You know what I mean? They should be listening to Dave Crossland longer.
I don't know about that, but I think if that was taken to task by an advertising regulatory body, they would probably pull it up as being wrong.
Okay.
You know, as breaking some ad rule. You've got to be very careful with this stuff, and it's in a lot of things. I mean, you see it in other stuff as well, where people get round loopholes in legislation because of how they advertise wherever it is they're selling. So, you know, they'll put stuff that might describe a product in a certain way, but then so they might argument say you describe a product as for trade only, but sell it in a package that meant you could buy it for home use. You know, so you satisfy the licensing around that product because it's for a specific trade, i.e. it's for electricians.
Yeah.
But you sell it in a format that is easily usable by the everyday person. So you then as a seller haven't broken any legislation because you're still selling a trade product to the trade. It's just you can't help it if someone who's not in the trade then purchases that product.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of when I talked to Rick Collins and they were talking about like the research chem thing. The only thing you'd have to do is like with research chem companies where they end up getting in trouble is that they kind of prove that the person who was selling it knew what they were doing and the person who was buying it knew what they were doing. But absolutely, I know exactly what you mean.
A brilliant example is research peptides because peptides are sold as research only because they are legal to sell as research only products. But if you at any point on your website that's selling peptides suggest that it may be used to create this effect in a human being, then you are creating a situation where you're no longer selling this as a research chemical and you're now selling it as a supplementation.
Yeah.
And straight away it becomes illegal.
Yeah.
And I know a couple of research sites that are very, very careful about how they word stuff. And even down to the fact that they don't sell capsules or tablets, they sell pellets. Because a pellet is a more of a trade terminology for a substance in a tablet form, whereas a capsule or tablet is more of a retail terminology in terms of supplements.
It's a vehicle for human consumption.
Yeah, so... And they do things like that so that the wording keeps constantly pulling away from that these are in any way advertised for personal consumption or to aid you in performance. And they're very, very careful that they have no descriptions, but they may post links to research articles.
I'll post
The onus goes to the research then, not to them as a company for trying to promote something. There was a company that got hammered over here a couple of years ago now. Nucleus Research that were selling SARMs and peptides and that thing.
Yeah.
And they jumped on it massively because they were selling cardinine.
I think you told me about these guys.
And all the press jumped on the cancer links for the studies we're gathering.
I remember that.
And it basically every headline ran, research company sells cancer-causing drugs to sports enthusiasts. You know, yeah, it's a load of bollocks, and it's a bit unfair reporting. But it was because of how he worded the terminology on his website. He promoted these products for supplements, for sports shoes. And that's why they hammered him. He would not have got handled anywhere near severely if he'd just sold them as research drugs.
That makes sense. All right, listen, one more thing I was going to mention. Since we can do this on the YouTube, I'll put a link to the conversation I had with Rick Collins. I think I can do like right up there, guys. No, right up there, guys. You can click on that right now if you want.
You sure it's not up there?
It's up there.
Or is it down there?
Anyway, I had a second news story to cover here, and this is interesting. I don't follow a lot of wrestling, Dave. Do you? I feel like you could have been a wrestler. You ever think about wrestling?
No, not really.
You got
it's something I've never got into.
I'm so surprised, with your size and the tattoos and.
I did my senior year in America.
Okay.
So I was at Triton Regional High School in New Jersey. I played on their football team.
No kidding.
And my best friend at high school, his brother got into wrestling.
Okay.
And he was on about, you know, you want to try it. But I never did. I remember Ian Harrison having a go, because he had a go for a while, didn't he?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, when he finished competing, he went into wrestling for a period of time. No, it's just something I've never... I used to have a hairdo like Dave Boswell.
Who's that?
American football player. He used to have a flat blonde flat top.
Oh, yeah. Was he for the Raiders?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Boz.
Yeah, he was known for like tearing people down hard, right?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got this WWE story. There's a guy, I'm sure anybody who's a wrestling fan knows Jeff Hardy. They were doing this Friday Night SmackDown video. And in this video, he is talking about being in recovery and having had issues with drugs in the past. And this is interesting to me. They edited out any reference to steroids. I guess that a couple years ago, he had been caught. It said, WWE chose not to mention Hardy's arrest for steroids in 2009. When they were talking about the arrests, they show the clips that the news stories had aired. And it shows him getting put in handcuffs and stuff. And I guess that the headline on that read, former WWE champ busted for steroid pills. Now, they showed that video footage from TMZ, WWE did. But when they did, they edited the headline to just say, former WWE champ busted for pills.
I find it strange as well that they will happily allow, in this case, if he'd have said, I used to do heroin or cocaine.
Yeah.
They'd have left that in.
Right. Yeah.
Because he said steroids, they took it out. But the only thing I can think of is because they're trying drug use of stuff like cocaine or heroin or even, you know, prescription pain meds and things like that, which is very common in wrestling. Prescription pain med abuse is very common in things like wrestling and stuff like that, because obviously guys get injured.
Yeah. And they're wrestling nonstop. They might be doing it every night and traveling. It's a rough gig.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, but they're quite happy to discuss those drugs because they're not really directly associated in a negative way with that sport.
Oh, yeah.
You don't think, wrestling, well, you must be using coke.
Right.
You know what I mean? You think of cocaine as a recreational drug that's used across the whole plethora of lifestyle. But obviously steroids are very heavily associated with bodybuilding and strongman and wrestling and those sort of things.
Right.
So it seems like they're very nervous about reinforcing any association of steroid use within the sport because it looks bad on the sport. While using other drugs isn't good, but it doesn't look bad. It doesn't reflect directly on the sport. It reflects more on the person.
Right, right.
And it seems that they try and protect the sport by removing these references.
Yeah, it said so. There was an article by TMZ. The article stated the Moore County Sheriff's Office executed a search warrant on Hardy's home. They found 262 Vicodin pills, 180 Soma pills, 550 milliliters of anabolic steroids, and a residual amount of cocaine powder. Cops say that estimated street value of the drugs was $2,500. However, the edited version that the SmackDown showed said the Moore County Sheriff's executed a search warrant of Hardy's home, where they found 262 Vicodin pills, 180 somas, a residual amount of cocaine powder, and an estimated value of $2,500. So they just took that section out, the 555 milliliters. So 555, what is that, Dave?
55 balls.
So that's a lot of gear. I mean, that's not just for personal use, would you say?
No, that's a decent chunk of gear. I mean, it's not huge amounts, but it's enough. You know, if you were looking at that from a legal point of view, your first thing you'd say is this is supply.
Hey, would there be any case now, in case anybody isn't familiar with our previous episodes that say they're just tuning into this for the first time, Dave is an expert witness over in the UK regarding steroid cases. Would there be any case, or have you seen any situation where somebody had that kind of volume on them and they were able to get through with claiming it was personally? Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I know a pro that got away with more than that.
Really? Wow. Huh.
But you've got to look at the individual and the circumstances and how they pace themselves. And it's not always the quantity, it's more the variant of drugs in the quantity.
But 55 vials.
Yeah, if that was 20 vials of Deca and 25 vials of test, uh-huh. And I'm a professional bodybuilder.
Yeah, who just likes Deca and test a lot.
It's very easy for me to argue that I use a vial of each a week.
Okay.
That's only 25 weeks.
Yeah.
That's a difficult argument from a prosecution point of view to pick apart, because what does a pro use?
True.
Show me a pro on record that's genuinely honest about. If I go on the internet and search pro cycles, I come up with stuff like Big Ramy on 15 gram a week. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
So it's easy to find open, what they call it, it's called open resource when you search on the internet, but it's easy to find open research supporting evidence that pros use high doses. It's a bit harder to find open resource supporting evidence that they use lower doses.
That's a good point.
And the general consensus of most users is that the pros must be using more, or that's the only reason they're that big. So yeah. Dependent, I mean, if you were, you know, a buck 80, you know, covered in spots and 21-year-old, you'd probably have a harder deal. Or if you had five bottles of test D, five bottles of test C, five bottles of test prop, then you're going to have a harder argument, because it's like, well, structure that into a cycle.
Yeah.
Explain that away in a cycle. And why have you only got five of each one? That starts to look like stock.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it depends on how it's made up, is the honest answer. And depending on the person, you can put together some quite strong. It's not so much that the arguments are correct, it's more that the argument is difficult to disprove.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, the game is with this that it's not what's true and what's not true, it's what you can prove and what you can't prove.
Yeah. Okay, we had some other, you know, there were some other news articles here. Various people have gotten busted. I've seen a few stories of police officers getting busted. We'll hold off on any of those, because we have a good number of questions. Dave, I know you had your stuff about C-Lank and cannabis withdrawal. Let's take a quick break. We'll get back and we will cover all that stuff and our listener questions. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip Blend, for instance.
That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
All right, guys, we are back. Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland, a.k.a. David Stanley.
Oh, God, I wish I never told you that. I really do.
I'm Scott McNally, and our programming, as you just saw with our ad, is brought to you by True Nutrition. Also, go over to crosslands.org.uk. You can reach out to Dave there about his services, help to put on some muscle during this quarantine. You're sitting around doing nothing. Get a hold of Dave. He'll help you. All right, Dave, take it away. Take it away. Last week, we talked about withdrawal, right?
We talked about withdrawal from cannabis use.
Some people roll their eyes at that, by the way.
Well, I can understand that. You know, there's a big range of opinions on how impacting cannabis use is long-term, short-term. I've seen people with severe problems with cannabis use.
Yeah.
You said yourself you'd had some experience of negative problems with cannabis use.
I did.
Some people are too stoned to realize there's a problem, and some people don't have a problem. So it's like, you know, you could say the same argument about steroids. You can say the same argument about painkillers, all sorts of different things. Caffeine, energy drinks. Salank and C-Max are two peptides that have been used, and I think Salank was particularly used in some Russian studies to help people deal with anxiety and such problems coming off cannabis.
Hmm.
Now, what we're talking about is people that are high-level users. We're not talking about someone who has a smoke now and again. We're talking about people that smoke habitually.
Okay.
So they're smoking every day, predominantly most of the day. Now, looking into, I couldn't remember what the peptide was, but when I had a quick look for it, I came across this little study which I thought was quite interesting, and it was a study on the pharmacological trials for the cannabis dependence.
Okay.
So this is basically chemicals that they have looked at to help people who are trying to stop smoking cannabis. And like anything in life, if you think you may have a problem with it, stop doing it, and if it's a problem to stop doing it, then you have a problem with it. Yeah. Very simple. So very simple test. So I probably, as we are well known, anyone that knows me, I cannot pronounce medical names for the fucking life of me. So I will get these wrong. But so the drugs were bupropion, and that apparently worsened withdrawal. Now that's an antidepressant drug.
Okay.
Nefazodone, and that improved anxiety issues when it was dosed at 450 milligrams. Fluoxetine, that caused a reduction in cannabis use.
Yeah. What was that? What kind of drug is that?
That's an antidepressant.
Okay.
Now, this is a bit of a weird one because this is levofloxacine and THC. And it says reduce withdrawal. Well, obviously, if you're taking THC, it's going to reduce withdrawal because
absolutely,
you're still getting THC. So that seemed a bit of a stupid fucking study of that to me, but never mind. Nefazodone and bupropion had no effect. Baclofen or mirtazapine had no effect. Huh. And fluoxetine on another test, but at a lower dose of only 20 milligrams, the previous one was at 40 milligrams, had no effect. So it would appear that certain drugs are dose dependent.
Fluoxetine. That's our show is brought to you. This episode is brought to you by fluoxetine.
Fluoxetine.
And that too.
Yes. They did a couple of studies using oral THC, which obviously reduced withdrawal symptoms like it would.
Yeah.
They did a study with a drug called, now these are cannabis agonists. So they did a study with a drug called dronabinol. I hope I said that right. And that was inconclusive. Then they looked at cannabis antagonists. And this is a chemical name. So this is CR141716, and it actually attenuated the effects of cannabis, and Rimavant, and that attenuated the effects of cannabis. Then they looked at opiate antagonist, and these were all done with naltrexone at various doses, and they seem to enhance the effects of cannabis.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then they looked at dopamine agents and entacapone at 200 milligram reduced cravings. So that looks promising if you are struggling to reduce your weed usage and you want to reduce your weed usage. That looked like a quite a promising drug, and that study was by Schaffer in 2009, and it was dosed at 200 milligrams. N-acetylcysteine.
Yeah.
This is a bit of an odd one. Basically, it's a shit study, I think. They dosed it at 1,200 milligrams.
Which is what I take every day, NAC.
And they it was self-reported at reduced usage, but urine cannabinoid levels didn't change. So
no, I quit. Totally quit.
Yeah,
I'm good. NAC worked. I took vitamin C with it, too. It helped.
And then a drug called... Atomoxetine, which is a new norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, and that did reduce cannabis use, but it had shitloads of side effects.
Huh.
What we got now? Bustin.
What are we getting at? I'm kind of confused here, though. What you're just reading off a list of things that had been tested?
Basically, it was an overseas study. It was a collection of studies that were reviewed as okay. what drugs were effective helping people reduce their cannabis use.
I see. Do you have a – you know what? Send me that link. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. You don't have to do it now, but, yeah, I'll make sure we get that in the show notes if anybody was interested in looking into any of that stuff. Now, you also mentioned C-Link. What is that exactly?
It's a neuropeptide.
Okay. And this is over the counter. I see it's available really all over the place if you do a Google search for it.
Yeah, it's, and CMAC is the other one, S-E-M-A-X.
Okay.
I think it's X. It might be K.
Huh. Nootropic peptide developed by the Institute of Molecular Genetics of the Russian Academy of Sciences. Huh. I like the sound of that. That place sounds cool. I'd like to check that out, Dave.
Yeah, it was, I believe it was originally developed looking into Alzheimer's research.
Oh, really? Okay.
I believe so. And they found it to be particularly useful at helping people reduce the cannabis use.
No kidding. I see it looks like there's a lot of I see a whole list of benefits here. I also see it's available at like Nootropics Depot, places like that. And I see places I see it on eBay being sold not for human consumption.
It's just standard research drug. So it's sold in its usual format. This is for research only.
Okay.
But it's a nootropic. It reduces anxiety, helps with function, helps with memory and focus, and reduces sort of, you know, anxiousness, anxiety, paranoia, those sort of things.
Study of randomized control trial of 62 patients found that out of those who took C-Link, had fewer symptoms of anxiety. One promising caveat observed in the same study is the greater decrease in the participants with pre-existing anxiety disorders.
Huh. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be quite effective.
Okay.
I do believe it's quite a long-term commitment, though. I think it's one of these drugs that you need to take for quite a substantial period of time.
I see. Huh. Okay, that's interesting, man. So this is something people could check out if they're really. I mean, I wonder what the drawbacks are. Have you heard anything about drawbacks with this stuff?
The only negative I've heard is that sometimes it just doesn't work.
Oh, okay.
The story is that it's supposed to repair damage long term, so it's not even something that you need to upkeep with, you know, continuously.
Okay.
Once you've done your period of treatment of 3 to 6 months, then my understanding is you can then stop using it. But I suppose with most things, if something helps you feel better and gives you a feel-good factor about usage, you're probably going to carry on using it anyway.
True, true. A study in mice showed C-Link's capability of improving learning ability within 3 days. The subjects treated with the peptide were able to learn quicker on an electrical test. That's interesting. You know, I had a question, Dave, that we had gotten last week on the YouTube page, I believe. It kind of related to dosing of cycles for the pros versus amateurs. In fact, you know what? I want to stop real quick, too, before I forget. I told James Macon, I'd give him a shout out. So if he's watching right now, he's over there with you in the UK. He is on the front line. He's basically working in a hospital. He's got two babies, and he said he doesn't ever really watch the shows on YouTube or on iTunes or anything like that, but he watches live when he can catch us after he gets home from a long day at work taking care of his kids. So shout out to you, James, and I hope that you are having a good day, my friend.
Yep, and all the best, and keep yourself safe.
Okay, so here's a question for the next episode. He says, this is from Dan Smith. We always hear of the doses of gear used by pros. What about the doses of bodybuilders at different levels? For example, state level competitors, national level competitors, that's on the outer, and then those in the top five. Lastly, doses used by amateur guys trying to win the universe and get their pro card that way. Do you see a difference in doses from European bodybuilders to American bodybuilders, not including the pro ranks? Because I guess there is a different level. Let's see if there's anything else. Let's see. Last but not least, I've heard it was, I recall a recent YouTube video of two guys talking about Aceto using low doses on his preps. One guy mentioned he was advised 500 milligrams of EQ, and that was it. He questioned Chris and asked if he'd forgotten to take other drugs, but basically it was just a 500 milligram EQ, probably some test in there too. Anyway, Dave, so high doses, low doses, pros versus amateurs. I've got some thoughts on this, but what do you think overall?
I think genuinely established pros probably tend to use a lot lower doses than we think.
I agree. I know it for a fact, actually. A lot of them do. Not all.
Yeah, well, not all, but my experience with the ones that I know firsthand, their doses are moderate. Some even regarded as low.
Okay.
One reason is potentially because they have the genetics, which is why they're pros in the first place.
Yeah.
Two is that once you get pro size, you're not really looking to put on huge amounts of timber. You're more looking to refine and finesse what you have and balance things out.
And maintain longevity, too, at that point.
And I think also when you get to that stage, you start to become hyper-aware of health.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say probably the biggest level of high-dose use will be in the amateur ranks, potentially in those striving for a pro card, definitely in those that are probably less seasoned in the sport. I think those that have been around for years sort of come to terms with and realize that more isn't always better, and right, sometimes less is more. And the longer you are in this, the more you become aware of health, because the more you're on, the more you start to see the impacts of the drugs. If not in yourself, definitely in people you see around you.
Yeah.
Regards country differences, definitely. From the experience I have, like the Eastern Bloc sort of countries like Poland and those sort of places, they do seem to have a much more fuck it, let's shove tons in approach.
Okay.
I've been told, I don't know firsthand, but I've been told usage is very, very high in India as well.
Really?
Huh. Now, bodybuilding's exploded in India.
That's what I've heard.
But what hasn't exploded is the sharing of information and education. So as a result, people are tending to use a lot more than they potentially need to.
Yeah.
I believe the Middle Eastern states used to be very similar as well, but I think they've calmed down a little bit now. But I would say you do, in general, find much higher doses in those trying to achieve pro than you do in those that have achieved pro. There will always be exceptions. There will always be those that have abused from day one. In the same time, there will always be those that hardly use a thing from day one.
Sure.
I mean, I know one pro is retired now, but he never went over a gram his whole career.
Okay.
Ever. And off season, he generally didn't use anything at all. He only used free comp. But he's one of these people that could pick up a pencil and eat cheeseburgers and grow. You know what I mean? he was just one of those types. So, you know, we've got to remember that genetics play a huge role in becoming pro, and very few people will have the work ethic, the discipline, or the drug tolerance to get to the higher rankings of pro if they don't have the genetic predisposition to do it. And they are pretty much relying on hard work and drugs. But definitely in those striving to achieve, you see some very high doses.
Yeah, I'd agree completely. That's what I've seen too, man. That, and it's not even like the guys who are in, you know, the top placings either that are necessarily pushing it. Sometimes it's the guys, because he said, what about the difference between like the top five at a national show versus, you know, 16th place? I mean, I think some of those 16th placers are jamming in the gear. I've seen plenty of people that I've known that are pushing pretty hard, and they just think this is just the way you do it. You know, where the guys at the top end, I mean, man, and I'll tell you, you know, Dave, I mean, I've worked with guys that I've helped like do very well in bodybuilding. You know, I think of people who've been very successful in, you know, even at the pro level, those guys, the better they are, the less they need too. You know, I was just talking about this with Scott Stevenson on Muscle Minds, that like some of the best guys, it's like, it's easy to diet them. It's easy to get them to grow. And then you add gear on top of that and they just blow up, versus it's the people that don't have the physical capability to grow, that they're the ones who start pushing the gear harder and harder, you know?
I mean, you will always get those that just don't understand or realize the level of dedication certain athletes to the sport. So they won't digest how strict they are with diets. They won't digest, you know, how hard they train, and they will think it because they can't emulate that growth. They assume that the difference between them and that individual is drugs. You know, but you also, like say, you get those with such gifted genetics that they'd grow whatever they did.
Yeah.
So when you add chemicals, they just explode. But you get those that are so dedicated with their work ethic, so dedicated and intense with their training that you know, they progress because of that. And then you get people outside of that don't have the genetics, don't have the work ethic, and don't understand why, because they're eating KFC four times a week because it's chicken, isn't it? So it's protein.
Yeah.
And they train for 45 minutes like a wet handbag, that they don't understand why they're not progressing. And obviously no one likes to be self-critical, so they think it must be chemicals. They're using more chemicals, and the internet will support that argument to some degree.
Sure.
I mean, I've seen men's physique guys on 2 and 3 grams.
Oh, me too. Absolutely, I have.
And I've seen British heavyweight finalists on 1.5 grams.
Yeah.
You know, and it's unfortunate that the sport has got very drug cultured. So when you speak to people, the vast majority of people, the first thing they'll ask, particularly in amateur levels, is what were you taking?
Yeah.
They don't ask how did you train, how did you eat. They ask what were you taking. The more experienced you become in the sport, the more you start to learn that, you know, drugs is probably the third factor in the pyramid, and training and diet are the first two.
Right.
And I mean, for some people, unfortunately, it doesn't matter how many drugs you throw at them, they just won't fucking grow.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had a couple, and it's not that they're not the non-responders, it's just that their genetics are so shit that they will struggle to put any reason, they'll put a bit of mass on, but they'll never be, you know, a finalist. They'll never be at that level of development. They just don't have the makeup.
But, and that's just reality, man. Not everybody's going to be an NBA player. You know, not everybody's going to be an NFL superstar. You know, it's just the reality. Not everybody is going to be an IFBB pro. Yeah, in our sport, I think that there's this thing of like that. Well, you got to think positive. You have to, you know, if you don't believe in me, then you're a hater. But it, in the reality of it, you know, it's just the reality is that not everybody can be a pro. That doesn't mean that you can't still be your best. You can't still have fun at it. And, you know, but it just might mean that you're not going to be on the Olympia stage. I've talked to so many young guys that'll tell me like, my goal is to be at the Olympia, yet they've never even competed once. You know, it's like, let's just like get everything reasonable. You know what I mean? Like let's be reasonable.
I'm huge on dreaming big and not limiting yourself and being the best you can be and striving for the stars.
Sure.
But there has to be a point when you go, right, I've been doing this 10 years. I've put a stone and a half on. Maybe it's time I began to realize that I either haven't got what it takes or I just don't want it enough. But whatever it is, neither is a failing at the end of the day.
Sure, sure.
And there's a fine line between encouragement and blowing smoke up people's arses.
Yes.
And it's a difficult balance. It is a difficult balance. And it's hard to be honest and constructive with people, but at the same time not destroying their dreams and hopes.
Yep.
You know, it's difficult to be a realist, particularly about yourself. I mean, I am never in a million years going to run the London Marathon. It is never going to happen. I don't have the mental makeup to do that shit. I hate it. It just fucking bores me stupid. And I learned very early on that if I was to be competitive as a bodybuilder, I would spend half my time absolutely hating what I was doing.
Yeah.
Because I hate dieting, and I hate the way I feel in the gym when I'm dieting, and I hate everything that comes with that, and I'm uncomfortable standing on stage. I'm uncomfortable in that position.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy the process, and I don't enjoy the end result. I like the look, but I don't enjoy the physical end result of having to stand on a stage. I hate it.
Yeah, well, there's people out there that would love to do it, but they just physically can't. You're talking about like the mental makeup of wanting to. I mean, there's people out there that are like, well, I really, really want it, but it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that it's for you. And that's not a knock on you whatsoever. So
I'm never going to be a sprinter. I'm just not built for it. I just don't have the physical makeup to do it.
Not with that attitude.
Exactly.
All right. We got a question here emailed to me. I was, actually private message. I was running 500 milligrams a test, 500 EQ, 50 Proviron a day, and 7 milligrams of Ment. Okay. 10 days after my last pin, my total test was 1,800 and free test was 608. I do not know what my ranges were during the cycle. Is that a normal retention rate? If it's higher than normal rate, should I cruise longer to refresh receptors? Is it beneficial to have a retention like that? This is just 10 days after a cycle.
Right. 10 days after a cycle. What was he running, test end?
He was running, he doesn't say test, but he says 500 EQ as well. So, I mean,
well, his levels are going to be effectively half what they were at the point of stopping.
Well, even the EQ is longer. So, I mean, possibly yeah, half, but
12, 14 days, isn't it? So, but the point is, he's going to be about half of what his peak levels were, maybe slightly above that. But I don't think his levels are particularly anything unusual.
No, I think he's thinking about starting his next cycle already. Like he just took a 10-day break and it's time to go again. I think that's what he's saying, because he's saying...
Right, okay. Yeah. Like, one thing is you do not refresh receptors. It doesn't happen. You can't refresh a receptor because it's dead after 4 hours.
That's a good point. You have new receptors.
Yes, which is why if you have an excess of androgens, your body will actually start to increase receptor production... to accommodate the extra androgens.
Okay, so
it's upstream of the receptors that the problem occurs, and that is generally to do with stress and toxicity created by the drugs. So when you get to that point where you're not progressing as much and you feel worn out and you don't feel like your libido is as high as it used to be and you feel like everything's just starting to slow down and crash, but your dose is the same.
Yeah.
It's not because your receptors are saturated or they've desensitized.
Yeah.
It's because your body is stressed. So when you stop the drugs, you reduce the level of stress, your recovery comes better, therefore you respond better and you start to grow again.
Sure.
It's got fuck all to do with receptors.
Well, and then let's address the, I think the other one factor before we moved on to address would be the rate, the time that he's considering taking off. He's only been off 10 days. No, I mean, you can't even start. Like if you were to start, say he wanted to do a post-cycle therapy, which it sounds like he's not planning to do, but you couldn't even start that post-cycle therapy for like another 2 weeks because that steroid is built up in your system for so long. Mm-hmm. I know this is basic stuff, but we got to share it with him. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, if he's looking Blast Cruise, I would be reluctant to look at going back on cycle within 6 to 8 weeks. And I would only consider that if it was because of comp schedules. Generally, I'd want them to be cruising for a little bit longer, get bloods down, particularly get health markers well in range, and just have a period of time of just being effectively natural, even though you are still on TRT.
Yeah.
If he's going back on 10 days, 2 weeks after coming off cycle, he's effectively not come off.
No, absolutely.
And any negative impact that the drugs are having is just going to be compounded. There's going to be no recovery on a health point of view at all. Yes, his levels will drop for those first 2 weeks, but you know he's not going to his body's not going to have any real state of recovery.
Yeah,
and he's just going to compound problems. And the thing is, you keep doing shit like that, you'll get to a point where I am having to deal with something after today's show, where someone has put themselves in a position and they finally had their bloods done and they're a mess.
Mm.
And I mean mess, as in we will need to have a discussion about immediately stopping the usage.
Mm. Altogether, huh?
Well, TRT, would PCT is not going to be an option, so it'll be TRT. But
okay.
Levels are particularly high in the certain areas. And this is just because they haven't washed their bloods and they haven't had enough downtime.
Okay.
So, you know, you can't keep abusing the shit out of yourself and expecting it not to bite you on the ass at some point. It will come.
It's as simple as that. About, here's a quick one. How about pituitary gland and growth hormone production after HGH use is discontinued?
Generally speaking, my understanding, and it's not something I'm particularly strong on, is that growth hormone recovery, as in natural growth hormone recovery, is generally quite robust.
Yeah.
I have heard stories of people that have subsequently had pituitary problems after long-term growth hormone use, but I haven't known if they've been substantiated or if it's just somebody self-diagnosing.
Okay.
So in my experience, as yet, I've never come across anyone with a growth hormone production problem post-use at any point. And my understanding is that the same with our thyroid. In general, they are pretty robust at recovering post-suppression.
Okay.
And in case people hadn't realized, yes, your pituitary production does get suppressed when you use growth hormone.
Sure, sure.
You know, we have these fail safes built into pretty much all our hormone productions, so our levels can't get too high naturally.
Yeah. All right. Rapid fire a few of them here at you. Thoughts on Primo? Is it worth the extra money over, say, EQ or Masteron, etc.?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a nice drug. It's a very good drug to get on with. It's a very comfortable drug to get on with. My biggest concern about Primo isn't Primo. It's just whether it is Primo or not.
Sure, sure.
That's always been my biggest concern around Primo. It's never about the drug itself. It's just whether I've got the real thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a nice drug, and I think it's underutilized. I think it could be used more than it is. And I think for most, it's cost prohibitive. That's why it's not used as much as it could be.
All right. Let's see. Interested in Dave's take on metabolic damage / adaptation with T3 usage.
This is probably better for Scott.
Yeah. Scott Stevenson. I'd be curious to hear what he had to say about it. I can tell you that I think one thing I'll throw in for while you're thinking on it, Dave, is just that I think that one of the keys with everything is being careful with, you know, being respectful of what you're doing. And if you were not abusive, if you keep it, the way to minimize damage would be to use the least amount possible. I'll be completely transparent and say that the first time I used T3, I was reading message boards that said you take it up to 100 micrograms, which I did, and it was not a pleasant experience. I got really terrible pumps, lack of pumps. I didn't have my diet nailed the way I needed to the first time I had used it, and I did progress in fat loss, but I didn't get to my end result. Versus if I ever use it with myself or any clients now, we just use it as like a replacement dose, because as you're dieting, your metabolism slows down. And if you're able to take just a tiny replacement dose and keep that thyroid production or level optimal, then, you know, you're going to be able to continue cruising along, almost defying what your metabolism would want to do, which is it recognizes the way I've always looked at it is like that it's recognizing you're starving to death, you know, is what it thinks. And so it slows itself down in order to preserve the few calories you get versus by taking a replacement dose of T3, it just makes your body continue to cruise along as it would in a normal state. And that's what I found to be, you know, super beneficial using it that way. And in those situations, personally, I haven't seen people have problems.
I've seen people have problems, but it's been generally more so due to very heavy stimulant use. So T5s and stuff like that alongside T3.
Okay.
Generally, I found most people with T3 use, though there may be a period of a few weeks afterwards where they're a bit ropey, in general, it recovers quite well. But where I have seen big problems has been in stimulant-based fat burner use. That I've seen have long-term lasting effects on you know, metabolic recovery. I mean, the whole metabolic damage things are very hotly contested subjects, with many people saying it doesn't even exist. I think there definitely are things that affect our metabolic rates and can affect them for quite a period of time, and particularly for over dieting or dieting too hard or trying to do too much at once. I mean, everyone says, oh, well, it's just calories in, calories out. But I've never believed it's that simple. There are factors that crawl into that that can cause problems.
Sure.
Particularly when we're trying to lose fat and maintain muscle mass. Yeah, it's very easy to get your body to dump muscle mass. But it's a different ballgame when you're trying to hold on to that muscle mass and just burn the fat. Then things become a little bit more delicate. Yeah, it's not something I've seen a great deal of, is long-term damage through T3 use. I've probably seen more thyroid interruption through steroid use, particularly DECA, than I have through T3 use.
Mm, really?
Mm. I've seen quite a few people have thyroid disruption through DECA.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen people have thyroid issues just from dieting really hard, you know, and pushing. So I think it's possible. I almost feel like I can't say that you would be healthier to use a low dose of thyroid while dieting, but I do feel like you don't have to hurt. So you don't have to grind I don't know, man. I feel like sometimes with certain people, and I'm thinking of a guy I'm working with right now, that he's just, every time he's gotten in shape, we've dieted like 5 contest seasons now, and every time, man, he always has to grind so hard, He doesn't use any kind of thyroid T3, anything like that. But I almost wonder with someone like that, if you were to put just a small amount in there, you know, what would it do? But at the same time, I'm not a doctor or anything. I'm not making medical claims.
No, but I think you're right in the same way as when you're pushing very high food, a little bit of insulin can just take the pressure off the beta cells.
Yeah.
I think the reverse is in when you diet. You know, when you're proper dieting hard, I mean, it's a big problem with women is hormone disruption when they're dieting hard and they've got very low body fat levels. And obviously, it does have an impact on males as well. So, yeah, I'd go with that as a low-dose supplementation in order to just keep things optimal when you're dieting hard. It would be beneficial without doubt.
All right, I'm almost 65, and I have never taken steroids or TRT. What are your thoughts on Androgel? And I said, hey, have you gotten your test levels checked? If so, do you know your numbers? And he said, yes, I'm at about 300. They didn't test free test. He says...
That's substantially low.
Yeah.
Well, I would have thought it's his age that's going against him in this case, isn't it? Because he's probably viewed as being a little bit too old for TRT, whereas he was taking it. But the thing is, the TRT cultures over here and over there are very, very different.
Okay. You could be too old?
Over here, definitely. Yes, definitely.
No kidding.
If you were 65 over here reporting low levels, chances are you just get told it's because you're old. Fuck off and be old.
That's bullshit.
But over there, you're much happier to improve the quality of somebody's life with supplementation if possible.
Absolutely.
Huh. Gels have their place. They do work. They have a poor absorption rate and a poor bioavailability.
Sure.
But they aren't without the users. And if he's that level, then I would have thought in the States he would easily qualify for support anyway, as in, you know, to get a doctor to prescribe. So there wouldn't be a major issue. So is he going for gel because he doesn't want to inject? Is there a particular reason why he's going for gel, or is he just trying to self-admin?
Maybe his doctor is telling him, we can get you a gel. You know, because that's what they want to do. Doctor wants to keep you away from the needles. I think it's just easier for them to be like, here's a pack of gel, put this on twice a day or whatever.
They're a bit inconvenient, but they're not, you know, they do work. They will raise his test levels.
Oh, yeah. In fact, when we had Adam Lamb on here talking about TRT before, his company uses a gel or cream or something, and he said that, his argument was that, and I bet you would appreciate this, fluctuation of levels, that a youthful male is going to have levels that are constantly up and down versus using a TRT shot once a week, you just boom, and then it's just it's a line, you know.
Yeah. So without doubt, daily application or twice daily application in any form of is going to be closer to mimicking natural responses to testosterone, without doubt.
Yeah, and there's less need for AIs, from what I understand, when you use that
much
method.
Less need, The more frequent you inject at a smaller dose, the less. It's all about keeping your levels within that range.
Yeah.
As soon as you start going out of the range, either top or bottom, you start creating management problems. As long as you can keep in that range, and if you're doing the injection, that means frequent injections.
Yeah.
I used to be a strong proponent of one shot and allowing it to drop off.
Yeah.
I've since changed my mind with that. And I'm much more now about small doses more frequently.
Okay. Let's see. We've got a few more here. One more here, and then we have some on the live feed. Let's see. Louis Zito. By the way, guys, anybody who wants to ask questions, join us over at the Advices Radio group over at Facebook, or you can post up questions right in the YouTube page, you know, on comments. That's cool. Would using EQ instead of test be a good idea for those with acne issues? Any benefits or downsides to using EQ instead of test? Thanks. I don't feel like it's going to, you know, I've seen people have issues with their libido when the EQ has been higher than test. I would imagine in some cases, at least, some people may experience libido issues that way.
I find EQ, I mean, take away the blood elevation, which I'm always very concerned about because it's what I see most prominent in users as a problem is thick blood.
Yeah.
Which obviously EQ does cause. it seems to be a very odd drug in the fact that I know people take EQ and it kills their appetite. It just stops it dead. And others, they can't stop eating when they're on EQ. Mm. What I'm not a fan with is using anything for TRT or going away from that simple base that our bodies produce testosterone, which then converts to DHT, and testosterone that then converts to estrogen to create our hormone palettes.
Sure.
So to me, whatever cycle you do, at least the TRT level of that hormone replication needs to be in place.
I like that idea too. I do.
I'm uncomfortable with doing anything that moves away from that. And though you may get periods of time where you're okay with it, I don't think long term it's sustainable. And that's why I'm against the DECA only cycle. It's just that same. We were designed to operate on test, estrogen, and DHT.
Yeah.
So whatever you're doing, be it cruised or be it dope cycle, you need to replicate those elements to start with to maintain health. Whether you push those elements higher or overlay those elements with another type of compound, that's your choice. But I still feel that you always need that base in there.
I totally agree. This is a good one. It's a training question. I like this. How do I make the mind shift from less is more? Wait, the mind shift from less is more. I think he's saying going to the mindset of less is more, from training 6 days a week to training 3 to 5 days a week, making improvements and enhanced recovery. So he's asking, he's doing a lot and he wants to try to, you know, here's the thing, Dave, we really promote here a network as a whole. Everybody, I think on these programs always is promoting to try to get the most out of the least, whether it be in drugs, whether it be in your training. I think that a lot of us, including myself, have gone to, you know, getting more out of less sets and less exercises, less, you know, workouts in general. Man, I'm only
talking with Scott about this week, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I went from at my peak doing 3 hour back workouts to now I do a back workout that lasts, you know, 45 minutes. I do it twice a week, and all I'm really getting out of it is maybe 6 sets, 7 sets, 8 sets tops per week, and that's in 2 workouts. So it's not quite Dorian style, you know, but it's not too far off from that. You know, I maybe do 2 exercises. 2 sets per exercise.
It's like anything in life. The more you do it, the better you get at it. The more proficient you get at it, the less time you waste doing it, and the more you get where you need to be quicker.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, when you're a runner, you get more proficient at conserving energy so that you can run longer distances. When you're a sprinter, you get sprinter, you get more efficient at laying the power down so you can sprint faster.
Yeah.
As someone who trains in bodybuilding, you get more efficient at stimulating the muscles, so you require less sets to get there.
Yeah.
The basic premise of training is that you break down muscle fiber, which then in turn is recovered and then grows a little bit more to compensate, so that next time you're faced with that load, you handle it better. You can break that down with intensity through either heavy weight or intense style training, or you can break that down through fatigue, more volume, where you'll wear through the initial surface fibers and then go deeper and deeper into the muscle to recruit more fiber to continue performing. If you're going from a high volume style workout into a more intense short volume or short duration workout, then there's going to be a period of time where you need to adjust, and there will be a period of time when your workouts are shit.
Yeah.
Now, what I found the best way of dealing with this was to set boundaries on how many sets I could do.
Okay.
Now, it was frustrating initially, because it may be, if I've gone from doing a 30, 35, I mean, I've never particularly been a high volume trainer, but if I've gone from doing a 30, 35 set back workout,
yeah,
over 5 exercises, 7 sets per exercise, and I've gone to a 14 set back workout over 3 exercises, then what I would do is, right, I've got 14 sets in which to do this workout. If at the end of that 14 sets, I didn't feel like I'd achieved the stimulus I wanted in my back, I would just force myself to walk away.
That way, next time you came back,
I was pissed, and I wanted to make sure it counted.
Yeah.
And you will learn. It takes time, but if you limit your sets and don't allow yourself to compensate, then you just learn to get more out of the sets that you're doing. You know, if you've got a limited time doing something, you'll make the most out of the time you have doing it. You won't waste time. Where if you've got unlimited time, you then to do a bit more fluff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely you do. Yeah.
So, I mean, I was always very, very similar. In the first couple of sets would be a piss take. It'd be a bit of a warm-up. But it would.
So I know what you mean.
But the Mimi training partner, you get jump on the bench, you start pressing. How was your day? Ah, not so bad, mate. How was yours? Yeah, what's going on with it? Ah, yeah, what's going on with that? You know, and the first couple of sets were that. Then the third set, there was a little bit more effort. By the fourth set, we were working. By the fifth set, head was down.
Yeah.
And then it never got lifted.
Yeah.
That was it. We were in. And that was it. That was business then to the end. And that was typical how my workouts ran. The first exercise was always a few more sets than the rest because I knew I had these wasting sets as I got my head into what I was doing. But I think if you're going to move from high volume to low volume, you're going to have a transition period. It's probably going to be, it could be as long as 4 weeks while your body adapts, particularly for certain body parts that you may struggle with.
Yeah.
And you need to start switching your focus from a case of just grind the fucker into the ground to making every rep count.
Yeah.
Your reps become more precious because you've got to get the most out of them because you don't have many. But the only way you're going to do that is be disciplined about the number of reps and sets you use.
Yeah.
And if you don't get it, tough shit, you'll have to walk away and come back next time. If you keep compensating, you'll never break that habit of the high volume approach.
That's what a lot of the DC training approach was about, you know, that you were so limited. You have that constraint. Now, I tried that early on before I was ready for DC training. And for me, it led to me getting hurt because I wasn't warming up properly and I wasn't able to bring that level of intensity. The best I can tell him is this is something like you just mentioned, Scott Stevenson and I, we talked in depth about going to a lower volume approach on the latest episode of Muscle Minds. If you're watching this live, that'll be out on Thursday. Can't remember which episode number that's going to be, but you know, we talk about the transition I made from you know, multi-hour back workouts once a week to shorter abridged back workouts. For me, Dave, I didn't do that. I did not limit myself and say I'm only going to do two. I just kept getting better and better at intensity. To the point for me, it ended up being a matter of saying, well, okay, I did two sets here and that was enough. So I'm going to stop. You know, I initially started splitting my back day up into two workouts, doing instead of doing like 16 exercises, I did, or 16 sets, I did eight sets.
Now, these are working sets you're talking, not total sets. See, I was talking in total sets.
Okay, yeah. So but then instead of doing 16 working sets, I did eight on one day, eight on the other, you know, two exercises of four each. And over time, I was like, well, I feel like I did okay with three. I don't need to do the fourth one. And then over time, it became, okay, I think I did okay with two, you know, and then that's about where I leveled off.
I think that's a natural progression as you become more efficient. Yeah. Whereas I think in this situation, he's being forced into having to lower. It sounds like he's having to make a conscious decision to lower his volume for one reason or another.
I think he's listening. This is my thought. I think he's listening to everything that we've been promoting here on the shows, honestly. And I think that he sees the flaw. And I think that the thing I've been telling people that I work with, my clients, is that if you stay aware of this, and that you continually try to make,
improve.
Yeah, you continually try to get better at it and try to get the most out of everything you do, that you will eventually just naturally progress to that. It took me a long period of time, and that's what worked for me. I think, Dave, that what worked for you has worked for a lot of people. Just limit that number of sets, and then you have to continue getting better and better at it, you know. After a month, man, you're going to be like, shit, I got to lift hard. I got to get everything I can out of this because I only have the one chance.
I spent a very long time playing with techniques and grips and styles, all with the one desire, generate more pain, generate more intensity in the muscle.
Yeah.
And even now, though my training is infrequent, it's nothing near the level I used to do. I still have that ability to generate connection and feel in any muscle group I train very, very easily, because it's been ingrained in me year after year after year. Mm. And the more efficient you get with the training, the more time out of the gym you have to recover, the more efficient you use your calories in that you spend calories in the expenditure of energy in order to create the stimulus to create the muscle growth.
Yeah.
So it's very much like, you know, my initial training, I was driving down the freeway in first and second gear.
Yeah.
By the end of my training, I had a 9-speed box in there, and I was in 9-speed with overdrive. That's how efficient I was at stimulating the muscle to respond.
Sure.
And it's the same sort of sense. So that way you don't waste calories in unproductive energy expenditure. Everything you do in the gym then becomes productive. I wouldn't say I dislike DC. I've seen it work. I know it works. It's very injury promoting.
It could be, sure. I found it too early, you know.
And I don't like the logbook approach, because the problem I find is your approach going into a gym should be, I need to damage this muscle to such an extent that it's going to respond with growth. The problem with DC in the logbook is that you go into the gym going, I'm going to beat the number of reps I did with this weight last week. That is not what our goal is. Our goal is to stimulate muscular response. And when you focus on reps and you focus on beating a logbook, it's only natural that you start to cut corners. Now, there may not be conscious corner cuts, but that rep might just bounce that little bit more, might just be that little bit faster. That sort of thing starts to occur because you're so focused on trying to beat the numbers you did the week before.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to.
It's a very hard training style to be disciplined in.
Mm.
You have to be very disciplined and have a great deal of self-control if you're going in the gym with the attitude to beat what you did the week before.
Yeah.
And I did train that way for a while, or for a number of years. Not really DC style, but I did always try and beat what I'd done the week before. It was always about progression.
Yeah.
Whereas towards the back end of my intense training, luckily for me, I had an amazing training partner. He's a prick, but he's an amazing training partner. Dom. We got to the end where I just didn't count reps anymore.
Yeah.
It was all about how the set went. And he was more the deciding factor when it was done.
Oh, no kidding. He could read you that well.
Yeah, because he knew at what point he was pushing me to the point of where I'm getting into danger of an injury, or where I was still doing the work and it was being productive.
Yeah.
And that's a fine line. It is a fine line. Yeah, and we've all been there where we've just lost complete feel in the muscle and we just feel like we're just throwing the weight around. And that's the time to pack it up and go home.
Sure, sure.
You know, you've gone past and beyond at that point.
All right, we had some more here. I'll try to see if there's anything worth throwing in before we go. I'll go to this one. We covered the Primo question. I'm not sure where to go with this one. Overestimated drugs in bodybuilding? Anything you can think of that's over?
Oh, that's got a better reputation than what it actually is?
Yeah.
Growth hormone.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'm with you 100%.
Potentially, probably insulin as well.
I don't agree with you on the insulin one. I don't, because I do think, and we've talked about it before. I get where you're coming from. Huh. My thought is that if you're shuttling more nutrients to the muscle, then it gives the muscle more chance to grow.
I get your point.
Uh huh.
But my argument is, feeding the muscle is not what makes it grow. Stimulating the muscle is what makes it grow. Feeding provides it with the nutrient in order to do so.
But what if you feed it with it, more?
Yeah, so okay, well, I'm going to build a house.
Okay.
So I've ordered 10,000 more bricks than I need. Does my house get built any faster?
Maybe your house get built bigger, Dave.
Does my house get built any faster?
No.
It's down to the fact your growth is based on the stimulus you create.
Okay.
Now, if you've created as much stimulus as you can, then yes, insulin is going to be helpful because it's going to ensure an ultimate or an optimum supply of nutrition, which means you're going to have all the raw materials you need to build that muscle.
Okay.
But if your stimulus is not great, then it doesn't matter how much insulin you throw at it, that muscle is not going to grow anymore because it has no desire to grow anymore, no need to grow anymore because it's not received the stimulus in the first place.
Okay. Let's go the other direction then. Somebody comment. I'm looking at it here. I'm notorious for misreading things.
Me, you both.
Walter said, I think he said underestimated, and I double checked. He did say overestimated, but let's go that way. What's the most underestimated thing in bodybuilding?
Old school.
Was that a drug? How do you take it?
No, just the old school approach. Everything has to be fancy. Everything has to be terminologied. Everything has to be, you know, micronutrient timing, all the rest of it. There were monsters around 25 years ago when all they did was eat eggs, steak, lift heavy weights, and train hard.
Okay.
So I think the biggest underestimation of what we do these days is that people don't appreciate the basics enough.
Yeah, I think that's solid, man. That's really good. If you plug into all the bells and whistles, but you don't have your foundation.
You know, somebody who has managed to balance the two, probably from a point of view of development, is JP.
Yeah.
He's very technical, but not at the sacrifice of old school rules.
You're right.
Now, you can argue to your blue in the face as to whether his physique is balanced or where his physique is a comp-winning physique or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But you can't deny the power and size the man has built.
He does like logbooks, Dave. There's that.
I know, but I believe he's moved away from that quite a bit. But then
has he?
JP's one of those exceptions of that man is incredibly disciplined. You know,
yeah.
You cannot knock his discipline and his dedication to what he's done. You may disagree with the end result. You may disagree with, you know, what he's doing. But you cannot take away how disciplined and dedicated that individual is to what he does.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is a marvel at that, you know.
It's not for me. I think it's – I mean, I was obsessive. JP's a whole other fucking level.
Yeah.
But I just think people look at the basics and it's boring and it's tedious and it's nothing special and it's not fancy and it doesn't have a name with 33 million letters and numbers after it. And it's not got four of the latest studies attached to it. And I'm not having to microbalance half an asparagus tip at 3 o'clock in the morning along with 2.2 grams of this amino acid and you know, 0.5 grams of this drug. And it's like, so it can't work. No, actually, lift shit up, put it back down, and eat decent food and you'll fucking grow.
Yeah, I like that.
I do think that the old school ways are very underrated. I still, to this day, have not found a cycle that is not more productive at just building straight old-fashioned raw mass than Test and Decker.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if you could take that to the gym, too. I mean, has there been anything that's been produced that's better than a barbell in dumbbells?
Really.
You know what I mean?
It's not the tool. It's how you use the tool. You know, the only advantage machines have given us is that they've allowed us to target the muscle with less technique.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's where machines have their place, in that we don't need to be as mastery as technique in a chest press machine as we do in a bench press in order to get the load to hit the chest.
Sure.
And so that's where machines are a big advantage, because they allow us to get better stimulus of the target muscle without developing the necessary technique we would probably need if we were using dumbbells or a barbell.
Yeah.
But apart from that, you know, people don't learn the craft anymore. And that goes back to what we're saying about feeling it. You know, people don't learn that craft of engaging the muscle and getting the mind-muscle connection and learning to feel the movement anymore.
Yeah.
And yet, if you spent a year, and a half, dedicating yourself to learning the techniques and improving your mind-muscle connection and your responsiveness to an exercise, and really learning the big range of exercises that actually are available. And this lockdown has actually brought out some really old-school movements that have sort of lost popularity because people don't have weights.
I was just thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're seeing stuff that's not been done, like barbell hack squats that haven't been seen the light of day for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, we need, I feel we need as or people would benefit from spending a bit more time learning the craft.
Yeah.
And the craft is just how to train. And most of us assume we can train, and most of us assume we can train hard. And time invested, even just spending time around people that are more experienced, or just time invested in yourself, in playing around with exercises and movements and listening to how you feel about it, and then developing your movement on top of that,
Is
time well spent.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that about wraps us up here. We're about out of time. Guys, once again, head on over to crosslands.org.uk. You can reach out to Dave over there. Check out our great sponsor, True Nutrition. You go to truenutrition.com. Use our code ADVICES. Dave Crossland, cheerio.
I've got a doggy under the desk. Bye.